Okay, folks. So today we're going to look under the hood of pricing. Basically, we're going to see what drives pricing. So to start, can you hear me? Okay. Well, the second row, you better hear me. The mic's working. You just have to kind of quiet down so you can hear it better. So today we're going to look under the hood of pricing, see what drives pricing. And I'm going to repeat something I said in the last session that I'll probably repeat again in future sessions. Most of the things that look cheap deserve to be cheap. So when you're looking for something that's cheap on a pricing basis, I said you're looking for a mismatch. I think I'm going to have given you the mismatch, but I want you to start off today's session by telling me what that mismatch looks like. So Isha, you're going to be on the in the driver's seat here, and I'm going to let you find a stock that's cheap on a PE basis, okay? Do you want a low PE ratio? Okay. Do you want low growth or high growth? Near couple. You want high growth, tell me why. In other words, low growth would explain away the low PE. You don't want low growth. You want low growth and, I'm sorry, high growth and low PE, and you want low risk or high risk? Low risk and low return equity or high return equity? High return equity, right? So you want that mismatch. I want you to keep thinking about those mismatches because today I'm going to introduce you to four other multiples. And with each one at the end of the multiple, I'm going to ask you for the mismatch, PEG ratios, price to book, EV to EBITDA. Because if you can get that mismatch nailed down, you're 90% of the way to doing pricing right, to asking the right questions. One other follow-up. Let's suppose we look at revenue multiples. We talk about why people like them, their desperation drives you there. One sector where you will see revenue multiples used a lot is retail. So let's suppose you're looking across retail companies. You're looking for low EV to sales ratios. Which of these three groups of companies is going to look cheapest? Might not be cheapest, look cheapest on an EV to sales basis, and why? Department stores, discount retailers, or luxury retailers? You want to give that a shot? Which of those three will have the, so you're looking for just low EV to sales, which of those three will tend to trade at the lowest multiples of revenues? Discount retailers. And what is it about discount retailers that leads them to trade at low multiples of revenues? They sell at low prices. So if they sell at low prices, they have low margins. with every multiple, I want you to think about what I call a companion variable. What that means is when I try to sell you something based on the multiple, that's the first question you're going to ask me. This company looks cheap because it trades at 30% of revenues. The question you need to ask, what are its margins? Most of the time, the answer is its margins are slim to none. That's why it trades at low multiples of revenues. One final picture, and this kind of brings home something I talked about at the start of the class, in the second session maybe. And today we're actually going to value brand name for a company. Now I want to give you a picture that I'm just going to let it stand on its own because it's going to drive how we think about brand names. So yesterday I went on the CVS website looking for aspirin. Not that I needed aspirin, but I wanted to see if I decided to buy aspirin, what it would cost me. And I found the CVS aspirin and the Bayer aspirin, both coated, both 100 tablets, both 325 milligrams. There's the Bayer aspirin, $8.69. There's the CVS aspirin, $4.29. Exactly the same ingredients, right? Why is the Bayer aspirin priced higher? Because that's brand name power. You can do the same thing. Sudafed, you've got the generic version. Pretty much all of those allergy medications are now off patent. You can see what the difference is. So if you can charge a higher price for the same product, which financial variable are you most likely to see that play out in? I mean, does it cost about the same to make 100 the bottle? It's pretty much the same, right? 100 aspirin probably costs you about $1.50 at most with the bottle to make. It'll show up as higher margins. And today we're going to use that insight to determine what the value of a brand name is. We're going to use that difference in margins between a brand name company and a generic company to drive how much a brand name is worth. So lots on our agenda. So let me shut off the start of the class. Let's go back to, I think slide 18 is where I left you. So let's go back to that slide. We're talking about describe, right? Playing money ball with the data. And you talked about how it gives you a sense of perspective, knowing what's high, what's low. And it's also a great mechanism for countering rules of thumb. Numbers that people make up. So people say 15 times earnings is cheap. A stock that trades at less than book value is cheap. And especially with EBITDA, you see these multiples widely used. 6 times EBITDA is cheap. I think it must be ingrained in a lot of private equity rule books. Buy companies for less than 6 times EBITDA. Is 6 times EBITDA cheap? Depends on the time. In 2010, if I use 6 times EBITDA, half of all US companies traded at less than 6 times EBITDA. Markets were down after the crisis. That's a very strange definition of cheapness, right? Half of all stocks traded less than that. It could be cheap in 2023, unless you happen to be in Japan. You see where I'm going with this? Why do we have absolute rules of thumb? Make the 25th percentile cheap. That way it'll vary across time, vary across. You couldn't have done this 50 years ago. Nobody could have figured out what the 25th percentile is. We have the data. We need to start using the data. I mean, how much time does it take to do this in S&P Capital? Like you can do it in 15 minutes. Take any rule of thumb and debunk it or back it up by just looking at the data. So just a general plea of look at the data before you start talking about something being expensive or cheap. There is no metric you can use across time that always works. So define, describe. Let's move to analyze. There are two questions I need to answer anytime I use a multiple. The first is, what are the variables that drive this multiple? Remember I said every time you use a multiple, whether you like it or not, you're making implicit assumptions about cash flows, growth, and risk. Today, I'm going to make them explicit. These are the variables that drive PE ratio. I'll give you a preview. PE ratios are driven by 3 variables. Your cost of equity, your expected growth rate, and your payout ratio / return equity. How do I know those are the 3 variables? Today, I'll give away the secret. I'm going to go back to a discounted cash flow model with a little bit of algebra. I can tell you what drives PE ratio, price to book, or EV to EBITDA. Not only that, in addition to telling you what variables are the driver PE ratio, I need to tell you how, as those variables change, my PE ratio will change. Let's take an example, PE and growth. As growth goes up, what should happen to PE ratios? This should go up, right? But that's the easy half. You need to tell me, as growth doubles, will the PE ratio double? Or will it go up only 50%? Because without answering the second question, I really can't compare PE ratios across companies. So here's the trick you can use to determine what the variables that drive a PE ratio or EV to EBITDA or any multiple. I come to you with a multiple. First decision you got to make is it an equity multiple or an enterprise value multiple? Equity multiples, you'll usually have market cap in the numerator, PE ratio, price to book, et cetera. And if it's an equity multiple, here's what I want you to do. Go back to the simplest equity valuation model you can think of. Why? Because algebra is a little rusty right now for most of us, right? In seventh grade, eighth grade, last time I saw algebra. So keeping it with the stable growth dividend discount model is going to make your algebra simpler. So it's not that you can't do it with more complicated equations, but start with the simplest model you can. And with a little bit of algebra, and that's all you need, and I'll show this to you with PE ratios and price to book, you can take an intrinsic valuation model, which gives you value per share, and convert it into an intrinsic value model that gives you the PE ratio. So it's an equity multiple. Go back to the simplest equity valuation model you can think of. Do a little bit of algebra, and you can tell me what the variables are that drive an equity multiple. If it's an enterprise value multiple, go back to the simplest enterprise value equation model you can think of. Stable growth, free cash flow to the firm model. Do a little bit of algebra, and you can tell me what drives EV to EBITDA, or EV to sales, or EV to invested capital. I know it sounds incredibly abstract. Let's take PE ratios, most widely used multiple in the world. Let's say you want to find out what the questions are you need to ask about PE ratios. Equity multiple, right? So I'm going to go back to a stable growth dividend discount model. In a stable growth dividend discount model, remember the value of a stock is the expected dividend next year divided by cost of equity minus the growth rate. Remember in algebra, if you have an equation and you divide both sides of the equation by a constant, it remains an equation. So I'm going to divide both sides of this equation by earnings per share. You divide price by earnings per share, you end up with PE ratio. You divide dividends per share by earnings per share, what do you end up with? The payout ratio, right? You're saying, what's this 1 plus C? Because I need expected dividends next year. The 1 plus C just brings the dividends out 1 year. Take a look at that equation, because you've now uncovered the three variables that drive PE ratio. The payout ratio, the cost of equity, the expected growth rate. It comes directly out of the dividend discount model. Now, of course, you might not trust dividends. After all, managers sometimes pay too much or too little. If you want to replace the dividends with a free cash flow to equity, you'll end up with an equation where all you have, instead of payout ratio, you look at a potential payout ratio, where free cash flow to equity is stated as a percent of net income. Take a look at that equation. As cost of equity goes up, what should happen to PE ratios? So the R goes up, the PE ratio should come down. As growth goes up, the PE ratio should go up. And as the payout ratio increases for any given growth rate, and that's key, I'll have a higher PE ratio. You have the mechanics in place to ask the right questions about PE ratios. Now, of course, the pushback you'll get on this is a stable growth dividend discount model. What if I have a company with high growth? The next page is going to look intimidating at first sight, but don't let the equation intimidate you. Can I write the value of a company when it has high growth? Yes, in two pieces. The first part of the equation is the present value of dividends during my high growth phase. This is a two-stage dividend discount model. That's all it is. There's my present value of dividends. It's a growing annuity plus the present value of the terminal price. So I've taken what we normally have in an Excel spreadsheet in 5 rows and 3 columns and written it out as an equation. I divide both sides of the equation by the earnings per share. I end up with a PE ratio for a high growth firm. And guess what it's a function of? Payout ratio, cost of equity, expected growth rate. Same three variables as I had with a stable growth firm. The only difference is I estimate them twice. Once for the high growth period and once for the stable growth period. Remember what I said about you want to know how as growth changes, the PE ratio will change? If I gave you that equation for the PE ratio and asked you, how does PE ratio change as growth changes? And I asked you to pull out your calculus textbook. Don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to do it if I did. Is there a way you can use calculus and to kind of answer that question? What am I asking you? How does PE ratio change as growth? Trust me, I'm not going to ask you to do the calculus. It's the first derivative, right? of PE to growth rate. As I told you, I'm not going to ask you to do it. But you can already see that if you write it out mathematically, you can actually take the PE ratio and say, what will happen to PE if cost of equity changes, if growth changes, if payout ratio changes, once you've written out that relationship. When I wrote my first valuation textbook, got reviewed by somebody in Barron's, and they said it's full of elaborate obscure mathematical equations. And they were talking about this present value equation. This was the most obscure math. But we're in big trouble when we hit that present value button to hit present value, we've forgotten the equations that drive it. This is just basically two present value equations. One is the present value of a growing annuity for the dividends, and the second is the present value of a growing perpetuity for the terminal value. So I'm not going to ask you to do calculus. I'm going to use this equation in a much more simplistic way. I'm going to give you a hypothetical company. It's a company that has high growth. 15% growth for the next 5 years. And then after that, it's going to grow 1.5% a year in perpetuity. For the next 5 years, during its high growth phase, it's going to pay out only 25% of its earnings as dividends. Why? Because it needs to reinvest to get the growth. But beyond year five, it's going to grow, pay out 92.5% of its earnings. Why? Because the growth rate is much lower. For simplicity, I'm going to keep the beta the same in both periods. I don't have to. I could have had a high beta during high growth and a lower beta later, but let's keep the beta at one. And finally, let's assume the equity risk premium is 5%. You know what the cost of equity for this company is going to be, right? With the beta one and a risk-free rate of 1.5%, my cost of equity is 6.5%. Here's all I did. I went back to the previous page. You remember the equation and plugged in the numbers for this company. 25% payout ratio, 15% growth rate, 6.5% cost of equity during the high growth phase, 92.5% payout ratio, 1.5% growth rate, and a 6.5% cost of equity for the stable growth phase. Stay in there for a moment. If you stay with those numbers, I get an answer of 29. You're saying, what does that 29.15 even tell me? If this company were priced using an intrinsic value model, so think of this as an intrinsic PE for the company, the PE ratio for this company should be 29 times earnings. Now, your first reaction when you look at 29 times earnings, that's an awfully high number, right? What is it about my example that's giving this company such a high PE ratio? One is high growth rate. What's the other? Yeah, good. Low risk free rate, right? It's not just the beta is one, but I'm starting with a low base. When you have a low risk free rate, the same growth is going to deliver a much higher PE ratio. We're going to use that insight to talk about how PE ratios behaved over the last decade in the US and why PE ratios today are lower than they were just 2 years ago. It's got nothing to do with stocks being overpriced or underpriced. It's movements in the risk-free rate. So if this company were priced on an intrinsic value basis, it should trade at 29.15 times earnings. Let's say you trust me, go buy this company. It's a high growth company, right? What's your nightmare scenario? You pay high PE for a high growth company. What is it you worry about? That tomorrow you wake up to a much lower growth rate, right? Instead of being 15%, it's 12 or... So let's see what happens to PE ratio if you get that surprise. So if your growth happens to be lower than 15%, as you go from 15 to 12 to 9 to 6 to 3 to 0%, not surprisingly, your PE ratio drops off. You're saying, what are all these other columns? I've computed how much the PE ratio will drop as a function of your risk-free rate. So I've looked at risk-free rates ranging from 0%, which is where the euro was about a year and a half ago, to 6%. Well, thank God we're not there yet, but we know there are countries like Turkey where it's 15%. So across every interest rate, every risk-free rate, as my growth gets lower, my PE ratio gets lower. But take a look at how much of an effect changes in growth have on your PE ratio as risk-free rates change. As risk-free rates get higher, the effect of a lower growth rate or a higher growth rate become much smaller. How do you wake up to this? So I said you buy a high growth company and then you get surprised with a lower growth rate. You know what form that surprise usually takes, right? Get an earnings announcement. The company says, hey guys, we told you we're going to grow at 15%, but you know what? We're growing at 9%. You get a second to reassess and reprice. You know what this table is telling you? The effect of an earnings surprise on stock prices is much greater when interest rates are low than when interest rates are high. So I have a generic question. Why, when you get surprised with a lower growth rate, is the effect much smaller when interest rates are high than when interest rates are low? Deep, you want to try? In fact, you're almost there. What's the value of growth? It's all in the future, right? The higher my risk-free rate, holding all else constant, what happens to the value of growth for every company? It gets lower. Let's take this extreme scenario. Let's say you're in Brazil in 1992. You know what the risk-free rate was? 5,500%. When the risk-free rate is 5,500%, what's the value of growth? Zero. What if I surprise you and say, I'm going to have more growth? Still zero. What if I surprise you into less growth? I don't care. As risk-free rates rise, the value of growth drops, so you're less susceptible to surprises. One of the dark sides of having the low risk-free rates we had over the last decade is stock prices became much more sensitive to surprises, not because the markets were becoming more irrational or more volatile, but because that's exactly what you'd expect to see with lower risk-free rates. So it'll be interesting to see whether this year, when you get an earnings announcement and you get a surprise, you have a smaller effect on stock prices than you did a year ago for the very simple reason that risk-free rates today are 3.5% and they were 1.5% a year ago. We'll see. But again, you're getting some sense of dynamics about pricing by just using a very simple example. Here's a second what if I asked. Remember I used to beta 1? I said, what if the beta had been 0.75, 0.5, 1.25, 1.5? No surprises again. As my beta increases for that given growth rate, my PE ratios decrease. So less risky companies should trade at higher PE ratios for any given growth rate than more risky companies. But most of the time, though, here's the problem. Less risky companies tend to be lower growth companies, and more risky companies tend to be higher growth companies. So if you're looking for a superstar here, you know what that superstar would look like, right? Be a company with high growth and low risk. At the other end of the spectrum, if you're looking for investment dogs, you're looking for companies with high risk and low growth. I'm not saying, again, you avoid these companies, but if you just load up your portfolio with low PE ratio companies, guess what you're going to end up holding for the most part? You're going to hold a lot of investment dogs because they're going to look cheap to you. That's why we do the mismatch test, is to make sure we don't end up with a portfolio of Bed Bath & Beyond. Right? Because that's where you're going to end up, is companies that do badly are going to look cheap to you because they're being priced to continue to do bad. Yes? They've delivered higher returns for over time, which tells you what? That when you're doing badly and there's mean reversion, you're not getting it because they stay doing badly, but over history, there's a history of companies reverting back to industry average. It's mean reversion. It's a pure bet on mean reversion. And for the same reason, if you buy high PE stocks and they revert to the mean, you get the same phenomenon play out. So it's true. Historically, they've looked like good investments. But there again, I think with a little more systematic pricing, rather than buy all low PE stocks, you should probably buy low PE stocks with characteristics that make them more likely to be the ones that revert back to the mean. Oh, one final thing. Let's say the CEO of a company which has high growth and high risk. Right? There are two ways you can try to increase your PE ratio. One is you can push for more growth. But remember, you're still a risky company. So as you push for more growth, you're staying in this. So there's not a whole lot of room for you to move, right? So whether you go have 5% growth or 25% growth, you trade at a low PE ratio. The other is, rather than go for higher growth, you go for less risk. So if you're a company with a 20% growth rate, think of how much more of a payoff you get if you make your company less risky. I'm stating the obvious, but sometimes in growth companies, people get so focused on growth and still more growth and an extra 2% of growth that nobody asks the question, maybe instead of focusing on higher growth, we should be trying to make our earnings more predictable, more stable, our risk lower, because the payoff is much greater. One final question, said the hypothetical. I said, okay, I've looked at beta, I've looked at growth rates and risk. What would happen to this company if its return on equity were different? Again, I'm trying to counter this proposition that if you have two companies with the same growth rate in the same sector, they should trade at higher PE, they should trade at the same PE ratio. So here again, you can see as my return on equity goes up for any given, and you can look at every growth rate, for any given growth rate, I will trade at a much higher PE ratio if I earn a higher return equity. I mean, this is a long-winded way of backing up what Isha pointed out at the start of the class, is I have a low PE ratio, I want a high growth, I want low risk and a high return equity. And the backing for that, you can see by just taking a simple example and working through how the PE ratio would change as each of these variables changes. So let me be very clear. We're not using these equations to actually price companies. That would be pointless because we can do a discounted cash flow model directly. We're using these equations to understand what drives multiples so we can ask the right questions. We can screen for the right variables if we decide to use pricing. So any questions on PE ratios? So I'm going to play a little game. I'm going to show you a bunch of different choices that I'm going to make as an equity research analyst. I want to play devil's advocate and ask me the right questions, because each of these I'm going to be screwing up and I want you to tell me what I'm missing with each one. Here's the first one. You send me on a mission and say, find me the cheapest markets to be in the world. You're a global portfolio manager and I'm the analyst you just hired. So here's what I do. I go find the companies or the countries which have the lowest PE ratios and I come back with this list. And they say, you should put all your money in these companies. Do you want to take a look at that list and tell me what you see on that list? They have, these are the countries with the lowest PE ratio at the start of 2023. What's a common characteristic you see across them? They're extraordinarily risky countries, right? Remember what I said, most things that have low PE ratios deserve to have low PE ratios. These are countries that have low PE ratios, but they're not cheap because they're very risky countries. So what's a mismatch you're looking for? You want a country with a low PE ratio and not that much risk, right? I looked at this list. Maybe the closest you get is Slovenia. So almost every other country in there, I can point to at least one or two risk variables. Yep.
Now, this is so independent, but I've noticed that if you look at India, the Nifty has outperformed the S&P 500 in terms of...
India and China have higher PE ratios than the rest of the world. You could argue that they're riskier. But what's the other variable that can explain the PE ratios?
Well, I'm just curious about in particular, because both the volatility and the return that have been better than the U.S. stock markets. And I don't know much about the politics of India, but I would imagine the risk is greater.
I mean, history, you remember, slice of history in equity markets, you need at least 100 years of history before you can make sense of it. We're talking about an 8-10 year history. And if you have markets that go on an extended run, they can look incredibly good just before they crash. I mean, I think though it is true, India and China have had much higher PE ratios than the rest of the world. And on one hand, you're saying that doesn't make sense. They have higher risk, but on the other hand, they also have higher growth and the growth has offset the risk and, you know, in a sense, push the PE ratio up. But that could very quickly change as growth comes down in these countries and the risk stays high. You have a much steeper drop off in PE ratios that you're going to see in these countries.
No. Right. But I mean, correct me if I'm off. I'm understanding you think is relative to China has far lower volatility over the last 20 years.
But remember, volatility is also a function of liquidity, right? You take liquidity out of a market, the volatility we're measuring is volatility in prices that change. A big chunk of the Indian market is relatively illiquid. So if you look at the Sensex and you look at the 50 largest Indian companies, you're going to get a volatility that's actually higher than the mid-cap or small-cap Indian companies. So volatility as a measure of risk is kind of a dangerous measure because you're looking at actual traded prices, and the less liquidity you have, the less volatile a market can look. It doesn't mean they're not risky companies. It just means you don't see it in the traditional measures of volatility. So you'd like to control for differences across countries, right? So I'm going to take you back to an example from way, way back in time, about 20 years ago. I went and pulled up a bunch of what were then emerging markets. So you have a list of markets, you have the PE ratios. If I just looked at PE ratios, the cheapest market in the world to invest in then would have been Turkey. The most expensive would have been Chile. But in this case, I'm going to give you three variables about these countries. Here you have interest rates. So help me out with each one. If I'm looking at interest rates, do I want low interest rates or high interest rates in a country? you say we have low PE ratios, you want them to go with low interest rates rather than high interest rates. The second is real growth in GDP. Again, if you stop and ask, what do I want in that? I want a high growth rate. And finally, I have a country risk score. The higher the score, the riskier the country. So if I'm looking for a mismatch here, I want a country with a low PE, low interest rates. I want high growth and low risk, right? You can see already eyeballing this data is just going to make you dizzy. This is where I said statistics can help you. So I opened up my statistics textbook to the multiple regression chapter. Remind me again what we do in multiple regression. We have a dependent variable we tried to explain, right? We have independent variables we're controlling for. What's my dependent variable here? What am I trying to explain? PE ratios. What are my independent variables? It's going to be interest rates, real growth, and risk. It's not rocket science. I ran a regression. This is what it looked like. So let's see how good your statistics is, and you can tell me what this regression is telling. First, what is the intercept? Tell me. Not much. It just tells me the level from which I'm going to build off. So you want to build. What is this coefficient on interest rates first? Tell me. What does the sign tell me? As interest rates go up, my PE ratio declines, and I can tell you by how much. As growth goes up, my PE ratios increase. And as country risk increases, my PE ratios decline. This is good news. You know why? Because all of the signs are consistent with what I expected to see. Don't get used to this. Because when you try this on your companies, on regressions, signs are sometimes going to go in the direction, opposite direction. You can't fight the data. That's what the data is telling you. You've got to use it. Here, at least, I'm getting data that's consistent with the way I expect it to behave. You're saying, how does this help me find cheaper, expensive stock? Oh, before I do that, R squared of 73%, is that a good R squared? Statistics classes ruin you for life. Because if you notice, everything in statistics classes has R squareds of 93%, 94%. To which my response is, why are you wasting your time doing the study? If something is an R squared of 95%, it's because you're testing something not worth testing. Like, tell me how many calories you eat and how much you weigh. Eat 50,000 calories a day. You're going to weigh a lot. You drink 15 cans of beer every night. Your GPA is going to be in the toilet. I can do all kinds of regressions to illustrate this, but it's not helping me. 73% is about as good as it gets. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth. So I'm okay. And I'll later talk about how high does an R squared have to be okay. And I'm going to argue that it's a wrong statistic to focus on, but basically, that's what the output does. Now, here's how I'm going to use this regression. Remember that list of countries I showed you? I had the actual PE ratios right there. I got a predicted PE ratio for every country. To get the predicted PE ratio, what do? For Argentina, I plug in an interest rate of 18%, growth rate of 2.5%, a country risk of 45 into the regression. I get a predicted value. And I do this for every country. So Argentina looked cheap at 14 times earnings. But once I control for the high interest rates and the high risk, I end up with a predicted PE of 13.57. So rather than compare PE ratios across countries, what I do is I compare each company's actual PE ratio to what it should be, given its risk, given the interest rates, given the growth in that country. Now, where does that R squared of 73% play out here? Can I give you this predicted value? Yeah.
I guess something like Venezuela, you can see that there's a big difference.
But okay, so are these predicted PEs guaranteed numbers? They come with a range, right? If the R squared is 100%, you know what the range is? There's none. It's a perfect number. The R squared is 73%, the range is going to be plus or minus something. And if the R squared is 50%, the range is going to be larger. And this is why I think rather than ask yourself, is the R squared high enough? Remember, it's going to come with consequences. If you have a low R squared, it's not that you cannot use the regression, but your regression is going to give you a wider range. Your company or country has to be much more off your prediction for it to be underpriced or overpriced. So when you look at this, basically, we're using statistics as a tool to control for things that we otherwise cannot control for. And it lets you make decisions about which countries are expensive or cheap. So if you get, I know I would send you the PE ratio for every country if you're interested at the start of 2023. I can send you the PRS score, which is the risk score for every country. So you can have the risk score. And then you want to put in real growth and interest rates. It's easy to pull off the IMF or the World Bank databases. You can do this across 160 countries. How would you use it? As a global portfolio manager, this might become the basis for you allocating money to cheaper and more expensive markets. And a more sensible, it's a more sensible thing to do than focusing on low PE markets and putting your money in them. So we've talked about why PE ratios vary across countries. Let's talk about why PE ratios vary across time. This is a graph of PE ratios for the S&P 500 going back to the 1960s. And you can already see that the 1970s PE ratios are low, then they rose. And of course, in the last decade, PE ratios shot through the roof. And there was a subset of investors, especially value investors, who viewed this as a red flag. They've stayed out of the market for the last decade. Why? Because the argument is PE ratio looks too high. Here are four variants in the PE ratio. First is your basic PE ratio. Take the price of the level of the index, divide by trailing earnings in the last 12 months, that's a PE ratio. Saying what's a normalized PE? You take average earnings across time because you're worried about last year being an unusual year. So not a big deal. But the last two PE ratios, one is called the CAP and the other is the Shiller PE. Not only look at average earnings across time, they adjust for inflation. You have all these fancy ways of estimating PE ratio. Here's why they're all a waste of time. Do they all move together? Yeah. Why do we waste our time? Because adding this finesse makes it look like you're doing something more sophisticated. At the start of 2023, and this shouldn't be start of 2022, start of 2023, US stocks traded, or S&P 500 traded about 17 and a half times earnings. I'm going to stick with the current PE because everything else, as I said, moves in concert. Your first reaction is, how do I know whether that's a high number, a low number, or an average number? How do I make that decision? Let's look at the drivers of PE ratio. To understand the drivers, I'm going to start by showing you a graph that's going to look odd, but kind of hang in there with me. What does the PE measure? It measures the level of the index divided by earnings over the last year, right? What's your alternative? If you think stocks are too expensive, what was your alternative? Putting your money into bonds, right? Let's say you put into T-bonds. Does a T-bond have a PE as well? You paid a price, right, for the bond. What's the earnings you're going to get on the bond? The coupon. So we have a 2% coupon rate. Effectively, what's the PE ratio for a T-bond? 100 divided by 2 is 50. So you're paying. So what you're going to see on the next graph is something I wrote about in a blog a few years ago. I said, I know people are freaking out about the PE ratio they're paying for stocks. But remember, if I don't invest in stocks, I've got to invest in bonds. I would, rather than look at the PE ratio for stocks across time, shouldn't I be comparing the PE ratio for stocks to the PE ratio for T-bonds? In a very simplistic way, what I was trying to argue is, you can't just look at the PE ratio for stocks, say they're high and say, don't buy stocks, because then I'm going to put my money in bonds that make 2%. I'm actually doing worse off than that of 10 years ago when I bought stocks at 15 times earnings. So if you look at these two graphs, you can see that the two tend to move together, not always in concert. But the biggest explanation for why PE ratios for US stocks was high in the last decade was that T-bond rates were low. What do they call this? You had no better place to go. So you basically, you knew stocks were expensive, but you said, given my alternative, and you had that condition, you said, hey, stocks don't look that bad. But this doesn't allow you to answer the question, are stocks overpriced or underpriced? So I'm going to do something with PE ratios that makes them more usable. If you invert the PE ratio, you divide earnings by price, and so price by earnings, you get what's called an earnings yield. And the nice thing about an earnings yield is you can graph it against the T-bond rate and think about it as making choices. I can either invest in T-bonds and make 4% or invest in stocks with an earnings yield of 5%. So what you're going to see on the next graph, the red line is the earnings to price ratio. The green line is the T-bond rate. So let me start with the easy question. Do the two look like they move together? No, most of the time, right? You think, what's this purple line? That's a difference between the T-bond rate and the T-bill rate. The T-bond is a 10-year bond. The T-bill is a 3-month T-bill. So what am I measuring by taking the difference between the T-bond rate and the T-bill rate? When that number is zero, what's happening? Basically, it's measuring the slope of the yield curve. And that number is big, a big positive number, I've got an upward sloping yield curve. When that number is zero, I've got a flat yield curve. When that number is negative, you're saying, who cares? Historically, whenever the yield curve becomes downward sloping or flat, what's the story you start reading about the economy? It's heading into recession. Historically, for better or worse, the slope of the yield curve has become a predictor of real growth in the economy. So here I've actually, the earnings to price ratio, I have the T-bond rate, the level of rates, and I have a measure of economic growth, at least as seen through the eyes of the yield curve. My first stop was, again, statistical. I said, I can see three numbers here. I want to see, at least at first sight, it looks like T-bond rates and stock and PE ratios move together. Statistically, that turns out to be true. When you do a correlation between how stock and T-bond rates move with earnings to price ratios, the correlation is 0.685, which means as T-bond rates go up, earnings to price ratios go up. I know it's you got to flip them in your head. So higher T-bond rates lead to higher earnings to price ratios, which is the same thing as saying PE ratios will tend to be low when T-bond rates are 8, 9, 10%. The coefficient, when you do the correlation between earnings yields and T-bond versus minus T-bill, you get a negative coefficient. What does that tell me? As the yield curve becomes flat or downward sloping, I have much lower PE ratios, or much higher earnings price ratios. Why? Because when you have a flatter downward sloping yield curve, you have lower growth, and basically that leads to lower PE ratios. Again, my end game here is to tell you whether stocks are overpriced or underpriced today. So let me try to do that by taking this 33 or 43 year history and running a regression of earnings to price ratios of the S&P 500 against the T-bond rate and the difference between the T-bond rate and the T-bill rate. Again, the starting point, the intercept tells me doesn't tell me much. So that's what so 3.59% is the starting point, but every 1% increase in my T-bond rates increases my earnings to price ratio by 0.55%. Think of where we are right now, right? The T-bond rate right now is about 3.3, 3.4%. There are people out there who believe the T-bond rate could go to 6%. So let's suppose one of those people comes to you and says, look, I think the T-bond rate is going to go to 6%. What is that going to mean for stocks? You now have the mechanics for answering the question. A roughly 3% increase in the T-bond rate will increase my earnings price ratio by 1.6%. Earnings price ratio goes up by 1.6%. I'm going to trade at a much lower PE ratio. You can now quantify the effect of what do higher interest rates mean for stocks. When you look at the difference between the T-bond and the T-bill rate, the coefficient is negative, but it comes with a catch. See these numbers in brackets below my coefficients? What do they measure? Or what are those numbers? What are the two types of numbers you can report in brackets? One is a standard error. The other is a t-statistic. These are t-statistics. Does anybody here remember what the threshold for a significant t-statistic is from your statistics classes? 3 is asking for a lot, right? Like 99%, right? It'd be nice to get 3. But 2 is pretty good, right? 95% confidence. Even 1.7 I can live with, 1.4 I can push the envelope. And if I look at T-bond rates, clearly 7.28, I'm way above 2, 3. So this is, if you ask me, is there a significant relationship between T-bond rates and earnings price ratios? Of course, there's no debate. But you ask me, is there a significant relationship between earnings to price ratios and the slope of the yield curve? Right now, the answer is not much. And I want to point to what this number looked like, because I've been doing this regression now for close to 25 years. In 2008, when I ran this regression, the yield curve mattered a lot more. And here's why I think you need to bring that into play. Every time we get the yield curve going, going negative or getting flat, you get a story in the Wall Street Journal or CNBC saying, the economy is going to go into recession next 6 months, anytime now, right? And I think that's based on history. It used to be true, but it's becoming less and less true. And you can see it play out in the data. For whatever reason, the yield curve has become a poorer predictor of economic growth than it used to be. And maybe we need to be a little less, feel a little less urgent to jump on and say, the yield curve is downward sloping, therefore the economy goes into recession. Now, let's suppose I gave you this equation right there. That's an updated equation. R squared of 46%, not bad. I'm trying to explain changes in PE ratios across time using only two variables. Then I asked you, are stocks underpriced or overpriced today? Is there a way you can use this regression equation to answer that question? What's the T-bond rate now? 3.3%, right? So plug in 3.3% there. What's the T-bill rate now? About 4.5%. You plug in 4.5. So you've got a downward sloping yield curve. If I plug in those numbers and get a predicted earnings to price ratio, right now I get about 5.9% as my predicted earnings to price ratio. Let's round it up to 6%. If that is my predicted earnings to price ratio, you invert that, you get a price earnings ratio of roughly 16.4, 16.5. Given where rates are today and the slope of the yield curve today, I would expect the PE ratio for the S&P 500 to be about 16.5. It's actually trading at about 17.3 times earnings. It's in shouting distance, right? So if you want to make a case that stocks are overpriced today, you better make a case that's going to come from a different place with a different argument. Given where rates are today, I would expect stocks to trade at about 16.5 times earnings. They're trading at roughly, if they were trading at 25 times earnings today, then I'd say, you know what, given history, stocks are overpriced. But that's not what you see when you plug in the numbers. So I don't know exactly what the numbers will look like if you plug in today's T-bond rate, but at the end of trading today, once you pull the T-bond rate, it'll take you 2 minutes to plug it into the equation, see what the predicted earnings price ratio is, and compare it to the actual earnings price ratio. You can invert and do the PE ratios and see whether you can come to the same, you know, conclusion whether stocks are fairly priced, overpriced, or underpriced. It's a pure pricing judgment. As opposed to what? Remember, we did an intrinsic valuation of the S&P 500. We had to do these elaborate dances about earnings and cash flows and payout ratios. The far simpler exercise, you're saying, given what the history of pricing is, are stocks underpriced, overpriced? Any questions? I'm going to move on from PE ratios to a ratio called the PEG ratio. It's a very strange ratio. Let me describe how you compute the PEG ratio for a company. We know how you compute PE ratio, right? Take the price per share, you divide by earnings per share. You say, let's say you come up with a PE ratio of 25 for your company. And let's say this is a company with an expected growth rate of 10% a year for the next 5 years. So let's keep it a five-year growth rate. You got a PE ratio of 25. A growth rate of 10%, you divide the 25 by the 10, use the absolute value for the growth, you come up with a PEG ratio of 2.5. You're saying, what the heck do I do with this? As with PE ratios, you want a low PEG ratio. That's an indication of cheapness. You know why the PEG ratio was invented? In the 1970s, a guy called Peter Lynch, you might have heard about him, legendary investors, and he was the first person to run Fidelity Magellan, which is the first growth mutual fund. So he's given this mission of start a growth mutual fund, invest only in growth companies. And he ran into a bit of a problem because at that time, the only tool that investors had to pick cheap companies was PE ratios. The rule was pick low PE ratio companies. And he very quickly realized he could not run a growth mutual fund picking companies that traded less than 10 times earnings. Why? Because they had high growth rates and high PE ratios. So he wanted to concoct or create a multiple that brought growth into the multiple. You see how PEG ratio solves the problem, right? If you have a high growth rate, you can have a high PEG ratio and still look cheap. So if you're a company with a 40% growth rate, even if you trade at 30 times earnings, your PEG ratio is only 0.75. You could come out as cheaper than a company that trades at 10 times earnings with a 5% growth rate. So the origins of the PEG ratio are, hey, we want to pick high growth companies. We can't do it by just looking at PE ratios. We got to create this concoction, the PEG ratio. And now there are a lot of tech analysts who've latched on. They use the PEG ratio to pick stocks. Now I want to introduce a note of caution here. The argument that many analysts use for using PEG ratios is they argue that growth is now out of the picture. You can now look at the PEG ratios across companies, you have control for growth. Let's see if that is true, that using a PEG ratio neutralizes or removes growth from the equation. To answer that, I'm going to go back to that two-stage dividend discount model that I used earlier for the PE ratio. And I'm going to divide first by earnings and then by growth. And if I do that, I end up with a version of the model for the PEG ratio. Remember the sales pitch, growth disappears. Is growth gone from the equation? It seems to be all over the place. It's in the numerator, in the denominator. It's a complete mess. And that's part of the problem with PEG ratios, is rather than neutralizing growth, it creates this very convoluted relationship between PEG ratios and growth rates. So to understand why this is a mess, I'm going to go back and look at how PEG ratios play out when you look at a hypothetical company. But let's take the parts of the equation that are still readable. Holding all else constant as I increase the risk in a company, what should happen to the PEG ratio for the company? To have the same growth rate, no. The PEG ratio should go down or go? It should go down. Same growth rate, more risk, so you have lower PE ratio, lower PEG ratio. Higher risk companies should have lower PEG ratios than safer companies for a given growth rate. Second, if you look at what drives growth and you look at return on equity, higher return on equity companies should trade at higher PEG ratios than lower return on equity companies. So risk and return on equity, you're on fairly safe ground. On growth, all bets are off. You ask me, is high growth going to lower my PEG ratio or raise my PEG ratio? I'm not quite sure, because it depends on what segment of the growth curve you're on. So I'll do kind of illustrate that. I'm going to go back to the same example I used for PE ratios. Remember the high growth company, the 15% growth for the next 5 years? I computed the PEG ratio for the company. And remember, this is an intrinsic two-stage dividend discount model applied to the company. The PEG ratio I end up with for this company, given its characteristics, is 1.94. This stock should trade at 1.94 times growth in terms of PE ratio. It'll be fairly bad. Let's see what happens when I increase the risk in this company. If I hold all its constant, increase the risk, across the board, the PEG ratios come down. Higher risk companies will have lower PEG ratios. No matter what beta you pick, what growth rate you pick, the higher the risk, the lower the PEG ratio. The reason I emphasize is that, you know, as I said, tech analysts often use PEG ratios to, you know, peg companies as, you know, cheap or expensive. Just a couple of weeks ago, I saw an equity research report on a tech company, a very risky software company. And the analyst had taken the PEG ratio for the company, it was like 0.78, and compared it to the PEG ratio for the S&P 500, which is 1.4, and said, hey, that shows this company is cheap. Its PEG ratio is lower than the PEG ratio for the S&P 500. You see what the problem with that is, right? You've got a risky company. It should look cheap on a PEG ratio basis. If you want to compare it, you should be probably comparing it to the PEG ratio of other risky software companies. And then you can tell me the company is cheap or expensive. But you can't compare companies with different degrees of risk on a PEG ratio basis. If I change the ROE again, higher the ROE, the higher the PEG ratio. So remember, I'm going to ask you what a perfect mismatch company is going to be on a PEG ratio basis. So higher return equity pushes up the PEG ratio again because growth becomes more valuable. And then I tried growth. And you can see what I meant about things getting confusing. Initially, as I increase my expected growth rate, my PEG ratio decreases. So you're saying this is good. Higher growth rates lower my PEG ratio. But there's a point at which it reverses and goes in the opposite direction. In other words, it's almost a U-shaped relationship. Initially, as growth goes up, PEG ratios decrease, but then they start increasing. You might say, who cares? Help me out on a perfect underpriced stock at a PEG ratio basis. You want a low PEG ratio, right? You want low risk or high risk? You want low risk, because high risk would explain it away. You want low return equity or high return equity? You want high return equity. So you want low PEG ratio, low risk, high return equity. You want low growth or high growth? The answer is somewhere in the middle growth. And already you can see why this is a mess, right? What does somewhere in the middle growth even mean? Can you go into capital IQ and say, find me companies somewhere in the middle growth? Try it out, right? What's in the middle growth? This is precisely why I think we should ban the use of PEG ratios in equity research. Because it's extremely dangerous if you can't tell me which direction something is going to go to keep using it to tell me something is cheap or expensive. The PEG ratio is an abysmal multiple. The fact that people use it doesn't make it okay, precisely because of this very, very, very strange relationship it has with growth. So I know why people use PEG ratios, but I'm very, very, I question anytime I see a company labeled as cheap or expensive on a PEG ratio basis, exactly what I found with that PEG ratio. So if you ask me to summarize what we've learned from looking at all these different graphs, first is high-risk companies will have lower PEG ratios than low-risk companies. If you just pick companies based on low PEG ratios, you're going to end up with a lot of risky stocks. But 25 years ago, Morgan Stanley, with a lot of fanfare, the Quant Group put out this investment strategy where they broke companies down based on PEG ratios. And they said, if you buy low PEG ratio companies, you will earn 3% more than the S&P 500. You know, what the question they never answered was, right? These are also riskier companies. Is that 3% sufficient to cover the higher risk? Because by itself, you've told me nothing by showing me low PEG ratios have higher returns. Second conclusion, holding all else constant, higher return on equity companies will have higher PEG ratios than low return on equity companies. That's why when you see a company with a low PEG ratio, you need to ask the question, what are the returns on equity in this company? Does that explain away the low PEG ratio? And with growth, as I said, all bets are off because of this in the middle effect of that's where the PEG ratios are lowest. Because you can end up with a low PEG ratio if you're close, I mean, maybe the way to describe it, if you're close to the average for the industry, you're more likely to have a low PEG ratio than if you're either extreme, either too low or too high, a growth rate. So PE ratios, PEG ratios. Let's talk about book value multiples. What drives book value multiples? This unholy trust we have that accountants actually know what they're doing. Right? Because what are you doing in book value? You're telling me this is the market value of equity. This is what the accountant tells me the value of equity is, the book value of equity. Let me take the ratio of the two. You know what the rule of thumb looks like with book value multiples, right? If a stock trades at less than book value, it's cheap. If it trades at more than book value, it's expensive. And that's built, I think, on this belief that book value and liquidation value are somehow interchangeable. Which is silly, because if you think about the book value of most companies, you're not going to get that in liquidation. It doesn't even mean much, but price to book, it's been around for as long as people have been investing, comparing what you pay in the market to what the accounting book value is. So I'm going to do the same trick. It's price to book as an equity multiple. I'm going to do what I did with price earnings ratios, go back to a stable growth dividend discount model. Divide both sides by the book value, I end up with an equation for the price to book ratio. The price to book ratio is a function of the cost of equity, the growth rate, the payout ratio. So far, the same three multiples that you had, plus a new multiple pops up, which is the return equity. I talked about companion variables. With price to book, it's always return on equity. So when I tell you a stock is cheap because it trades at a low price to book ratio, and I allow you only one question, that question should always be, what's the return equity of this company? Because most of the time when something trades at a low multiple of book value, it's because it is an abysmally low return on equity. But I can actually take this equation for the price to book and simplify it by taking, remember that when we talked about sustainable growth, does anybody remember what the growth in earnings per share was written as in the sustainable growth equation? It was a product of two numbers. One was the return equity and the other was, nobody remember, the retention ratio. Right? Remember we wrote that as one minus the payout ratio. If I plug that back into the price to book ratio equation, something magical happens. The price to book ratio for a company can actually be written as the return on equity minus the growth rate in the numerator and the cost of equity minus the growth rate in the denominator. If you believe that equation, when should stocks trade at roughly book value? What should be true about the return on equity? Should be roughly equal to the cost of equity. If your stock trading at less than book value, it's because its return equity is less than the cost of equity. If it trades at well above book value, it's because it has a return equity well above the cost of equity. Price to book ratios are a function of return equity and cost of equity. Now, if I wanted to take the price to book, of course, is an equity multiple. If I wanted to give you the enterprise value analog to this, instead of price, what am I going to do? I'm going to use enterprise value, market value of equity plus market value of debt minus cash. And instead of book value of equity, what do I use in the denominator? I'm going to start with book value of equity plus book value of debt minus cash, which is invested capital. If I replace this equation with enterprise value to invested capital, what's the right-hand side going to look like? In terms of return on equity, if I'm looking at an enterprise value multiple, in terms of return on equity, what should I be using instead? Return on invested capital. Instead of cost of equity, I'm going to use cost of capital. In fact, enterprise value to invested capital is return on capital minus the growth rate divided by cost of capital minus the growth rate. Everything we talked about, excess returns, how they value growth depends on how much, that plays out here. It's exactly the same effect playing out in a multiple. So with price earnings, it's growth, payout, and risk. With PEG ratio, it's growth, payout, and risk, but growth has a strange relationship. With price to book, it's growth, payout, risk, and return on equity. With enterprise value invested capital, it's growth, payout, you know, not payout, but retention ratio, risk, and return. So basically, you can see the drivers of each of these multiples just by doing the basic algebra. Enterprise value to EBITDA. When I first started in equity research in the mid-80s, I think out of every 100 equity research reports, maybe one used EV to EBITDA. Today, we walk into almost any equity research department anywhere in the world. A third or more of all equity research is built on EV to EBITDA. And there are good reasons and bad reasons for why you've seen a shift away from PE to EV to EBITDA. Give me some of the good reasons why equity research has shifted away from price earnings ratios to EV to EBITDA multiples. Yes. So very volatile. Confusing might not, but it's a much more, so you're saying net income is much more volatile than EBITDA, so price earnings ratios tend, so one reason is EV to EBITDA doesn't jump around as much as PE ratios, so it's, you know, it's, you can use it more, okay? One good reason. Yeah. It turns out that capital structure affects everything, but PE is affected more by the capital structure than EV to EBITDA, because if I take a lot of debt, I can make my PE ratio high or low depending on. So second is it is affected more by leverage than EV to EBITDA. What else? Well, if you have lots of debt and you have a bad year, you know, guess what? Earnings can cut both directions. They can either, in a really good year, the earnings can look really good. So your PE ratio can be low. So markets know that. So your PE ratios tend to swing from very low to very high numbers for highly levered companies. Third, remember when I showed you the distribution for PE ratios? I started with 7,000 something companies and ended up with 3,000. And why did I throw out 4,000? Because they had negative net income. Some companies have negative EBITDA as well, but there are far fewer companies with negative EBITDA than negative net income. And that's a good thing. You lose fewer firms. So there's some good reasons why we've shifted away. And you also have to worry less about depreciation methods and some companies using straight line and others using accelerated depreciation. But there's one really bad reason for shifting away from PE ratios. Most of us, even if we're amateurs in markets, we don't follow markets much, have a sense of what a high number looks like in a PE ratio, right? So if I say, you know, this stock has a PE of 50, you're probably going to say, that sounds like a high number. Why? Because you've been listening to CNBC or off and on something, and you say 18 times earnings, 20 times earnings, 50 times earnings sounds high. If I come to you and say, this stock has an EV to EBITDA of 10, most of us have no sense of what a high or a low number is. So you know what happens is, as human beings, when you don't have a frame of reference, guess what you compare it to? You know you shouldn't be doing it, but 10 times EBITDA gets compared to 18 times earnings. They say both earnings numbers, 10 times EBITDA must be a low number. You see why people selling companies use EV to EBITDA multiples? When they say 8 times EBITDA, you get all excited. That sounds cheap. Why? Because you have no frame of reference. It's easy to develop a frame of reference if you want to, but the next time you run into an analyst using EV to EBITDA multiples, ask them a very simple question. What is the median EV to EBITDA multiple for the market? I ask this question every single time. I almost never get the right answer. So how the heck can you walk around telling me something is cheap based on a multiple if you don't know what the typical value looks like in the market? Yep. It's not even the unsophisticated. Most of us are unsophisticated. If I asked, if I went around, would you consider yourself unsophisticated? I would wager if you went to on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, or you walked into an investment bank and you walked around asking bankers, what's the median EV to EBITDA for the market? Not one of them will know the answer. They'll tell you, I can tell you what it is for my sector. No, I don't, that's not the answer I want. I want to know what it's for the market. The reason is it's not talked about. The only reason we know what PE ratios are is it's become part of the conversation, right? Whether we like it or not, people talk about it. When was the last time on CNBC people said the EV to EBITDA for the market is? I've never heard it. And people take advantage of it. And of course, when I go to EV to per user, EV per subscriber, it gets even worse because I've been even less of a frame of reference. So when you think about what's driven the growth of EV to EBITDA, I know it's a bad reason, but it's a reason that you can sell some real dogs using EV to EBITDA multiples. They look cheap because you're not used to using those numbers. You don't have a frame of reference of those numbers. So for better or worse, we're surrounded by EV to EBITDA. So I want to give you the tools to address what are the questions I need to ask when somebody tries to sell me something based on EV to EBITDA model. So again, by now you know the trick, right? So you should be getting bored at this point because you know I'm going back to the same rule book over and over again. EV to EBITDA is an enterprise value multiple, right? So I go back to the simplest enterprise value equation that I can think of. Free cash flow of the firm next year divided by cost of capital minus growth. I'm going to do something that looks silly, but I'm going to do it anyway. I can actually write free cash flow of the firm in terms of EBITDA. It makes my algebra a little easier if I have EBITDA on the right-hand side as well. So EBITDA times 1 minus T plus depreciate. Trust me, it is exactly the same thing as your traditional free cash flow of the firm calculation. Then I divide both sides of the equation by EBITDA. So I'm going to list out the variables that drive EV to EBITDA. In your mind, I want you to start thinking about what a cheap company will look like on an EV to EBITDA basis. First up is your tax rate. The higher your tax rate, the lower your EV to EBITDA is going to be as a company. Notice when we did PE ratios, we didn't care about tax rates, right? Why, when you use PE ratios, do you not care about tax rates? But when you use EV to EBITDA, you got to care about taxes. When I do PE ratios, what's in my denominator? Net income or earnings per share, right? So if I have high taxes, it's already in my income. If I use a pre-tax number, this is true not just for EBITDA, if I use EBIT or any pre-tax number, I've got to stop and ask the question, what's your tax rate? Because for all I know, your tax rate might be 100%, in which case, why am I paying for your company, right? Now, it sounds absurd, but I need to know what the tax rate is. Second stop is I'm going to ask you what your depreciation, capex, and change in working capital. But if you think about those three items, is there an item we had in our valuation where those three items got consolidated? That's my reinvestment. Holding all its constant, the more my reinvestment is for any given growth rate, the lower my EV to EBITDA is going to be. Why? Because if I'm reinvesting more to deliver the same growth rate, I'm being less efficient. So tax rates matter, reinvestment matters. Go to the denominator. Holding all its constant, the higher my cost of capital, the lower my EV to EBITDA. Riskier companies should trade at lower EV to EBITDA multiples. And finally, holding all its constant, the higher my growth rate, the higher my EV to EBITDA. So help me out here. Give me a cheap company in an EV to EBITDA basis. I want a low EV to EBITDA. Tax rate, do I want a low tax rate or a high tax rate? I want a low tax rate because a high tax rate would explain away. So I want a low tax rate. Do I want a low cost of capital or a high cost of capital? I want a low cost of capital, low EV to EBITDA, low tax rate, low cost of capital. Low growth or high growth? I want high growth. And finally, when you look at reinvestment, for a given growth rate, I want as low a reinvestment as I can find. So when you look at companies again, you're trying to find that combination that makes for a cheap company, because a lot of companies that trade at low EV to EBITDA multiples have terrible returns on capital, have reinvest huge amounts, or have high costs of capital, which explains why they trade at the multiples that they do. So as with my PE ratio example, I'm going to go back to the nice thing about working with a hypothetical company is you can hold everything else constant and change one thing at a time. So I have a company which has a 36% tax rate, capex is 30% of EBITDA, depreciation is 20% of EBITDA, cost of capital is 10%. For the moment, let's ignore working capital, one less variable to keep in mind. If you plug the numbers in, the EV to EBITDA for this company should be 8.24. Again, this is an intrinsic value EV to EBITDA. So it's a discounted cash flow model. That's what the EV to EBITDA should be. Sounds about right? 8 times EBITDA, but that's with the 36% tax rate. You know what that number would look like if that is 0% tax rate? It'd be 16 times EBITDA. If the tax rate were 50%, it'll be less than 6 times EBITDA. You're saying, when would I ever have differences in tax rates like those? Let's say you decide to become, or you get hired to become the telecom analyst for Europe. Think of who's in your sector. You've got Deutsche Telekom, which is roughly 30% tax rate. You have Irish Telecom, which is a 12% tax rate. If you pick companies based on low EV to EBITDA, Deutsche Telekom is always going to look cheap and Irish Telecom is always going to look expensive. Increasingly, as our databases become global and we're comparing companies across different countries, especially on an EV to EBITDA basis, you've got to control for differences in tax rates. If I hold my growth rate constant, increase my net capex as a percentage of EBITDA. In other words, I've got to reinvest more to deliver the same growth rate. My EV to EBITDA gets lower because I'm being less efficient about delivering growth rate, which is just another way of saying if my return on capital is higher for a company for any given cost of capital, I will pay a much higher EV to EBITDA for a company. Again, I'm providing backing for that pricing that you did. I want a company with a low EV to EBITDA, a low tax rate, low reinvestment, and a high return on capital, because that's going to be the company that's really cheap. It's not a company that deserves to be cheap. I know you guys are exhausted. Last multiple. You know why people like revenue multiples, right? Because you get desperate. You move up the income statement. And there are two versions of revenue multiples you run into. One is price to sales. And we talked about what's wrong with price to sales. Somebody remind me again why price to sales is problematic. Because my numerator is market cap, which is just equity value, and my denominator is revenue, which belongs to everybody, right? Which is one reason why when you see revenue multiples, you should be using EV to sales, no matter whether the company has debt or no debt. Don't fall into the trap of using price to sales, even though it might seem simpler because it's just internally inconsistent. The EV to sales. What do you think the companion variable is for EV to sales? I think you gave it away because when we did that discount retailers, what do we say it was? It's margins. So when I do the algebra, and I'll save you, I won't torture you by going through the algebra again, but if you want to trust me on the algebra, there's the variable that drives EV to sales, the companion variable. What's your after-tax operating margin? Higher margin companies will trade at higher multiples of revenues. Lower margin companies should trade at lower multiples of revenues. I'm going to end the session today by using this to talk about the value of a brand name. As I said, brand name companies have pricing power. If you have pricing power, you have higher margins. So one way to think about the value of a brand name is ask yourself, what will happen to my company if I lose that pricing power? Every brand name company, that's your biggest fear, right? What if I lose the pricing power? And you can actually value the company with its existing margins and revalue the company with lower margins. That difference should be the value of a brand name. So it was about maybe 20 years ago. Somebody had gone through this class, went to work for Coca-Cola, called me and he said, can you come into Atlanta and talk to our management team about the value of a brand name? They're kind of obsessed about brand name value at Coca-Cola. And they want to get a number because they know accountants are going to try to put a number. And I said, sure. So I showed up. And the management team had gathered together. I brought a Pepsi with me because I wanted to really piss them off. But because they weren't paying me, they couldn't do a thing. And I took them through a valuation of Coca-Cola. So initially, I valued Coca-Cola. And let's face it, Coca-Cola is a company that's unique among beverage companies because they spun off their bottling arm. So all you have in Coca-Cola is a syrup. So it's as close to pure brand name as you can get. So I value them with their, and they had some really good characteristics, that high margins and a high return on capital and a high growth rate. I played it to, I come up with a value of about 80 billion. I finished the valuation. Person in the front row, head marketing honcho, Coca-Cola puts up his hand and he says, But you forgot something very important. You said, what did I forget? A beverage, a geography? So what did I forget? You've forgotten the fact that Coca-Cola is one of the most valuable brand names in the world. I said, what exactly do you want me to do? He said, you should be adding at least a 20% premium. I said, why? He said, because that's what we do at Coca-Cola, is when we buy brand name companies in other countries, we value them and then we add 20%. I said, just because you do stupid things doesn't mean I have to do stupid things too. He said, don't you think our brand name has value? I said, it's the only thing in this building of any value. The rest of you I can get rid of. You leave the brand name, the value is going to stay intact. He says, why aren't you adding a premium? I said, it's already in there. He said, where? I said, everywhere. He said, why do you think you have a 15.57% margin? Is it because you think taste actually matters? No, it's got nothing to do with taste. It's got everything to do with brand name, 15.57% margins. That return on capital coming entirely from brand name. You know what he said? I don't believe you. This is what happens when you argue with marketing people. This is exactly the kind of response you get. But I came prepared. I knew this question was coming, and I got lucky. I found a company called Cott. It's a Canadian company that sells almost as many cans of soda as Coca-Cola does. You've never heard of it, right? You walk into a grocery store, you know the generic sodas that you find? Take a look at who makes these sodas. It's usually Cott. They let you brand your own name. That's why you never see their name. They don't put Cott sodas. You can put Grand Union or whatever the grocery store is. I said, okay, let's play a game. Let's suppose we all wake up tomorrow with selective amnesia, the entire world. And the only thing we don't recognize is that red can and the words Coca-Cola. It's every marketing person's nightmare. Let's make it come true. Your brand name goes away. What happens? Your pricing power goes with it, right? You know what Cott's margins are? 5.28%, one third of Coca-Cola's margins. So here's what I did. I took Coca-Cola. I'm not comparing Coca-Cola with Cott. I'm comparing Coca-Cola with Coca-Cola without its brand name, giving it generic margins. It has a ripple effect. Lower margins translate into lower returns on capital. Lower returns on capital translate into lower growth rates. You trace it all the way down. The value that I get for Coca-Cola with its brand name gone is $15.4 billion. You want me to add a brand name premium? I just did. In fact, you take the difference between those two numbers, I have a $64 billion value I've attached to the brand name. If you don't think it's enough, tell me why. But don't ask me to add 20%. I'll leave you with an anecdote about what to think about all these things that get thrown at you after you do evaluation. Sometimes physically thrown, in which case get out of the way. Is it, you know, there used to be this old commercial for a spaghetti sauce called Ragu spaghetti sauce. Still around, but there's a commercial that used to run all the time. And the way the commercial plays out is this 45-year-old Italian man is visiting his mother for dinner. He's a big-time loser. You can tell he shows up at his mother's house for dinner all the time. So he walks into the kitchen. This is how the commercial plays out. And the mother's at the kitchen stirring this big pot of spaghetti sauce surrounded by empty bottles of Ragu. He says, Mom, what are you doing? You used to make spaghetti sauce from scratch. Why are you making it out of a bottle? And he starts listing out the ingredients. I'm not that good at spaghetti sauce ingredients if something doesn't belong. So where's the tomatoes? It's in there. Where's the oregano? It's in there. Where's the cayenne? It's in there. I'm Indian. I throw cayenne into everything. So basically the response for everything is it's in there. And that should be the way you think about valuation. If you do a good valuation, it should all be in there. There are no garnishing allowed where you're thrown at the top. So as you look at brand name, and when we start next session, I'm going to talk about why it's more difficult to value brand name at a company like Apple than it is for Coca-Cola. But think about brand name through pricing power, and it's going to give you at least an opening for why you add a premium to these companies.